Selected Shorts is supported in part by the loyal friends of Selected Shorts. To join, or for more information, visit selectedshorts.org.
From that split second onward, when he did not salute the guard and the tram started, just then, the world broke into sound.
This week on Selected Shorts, a released prisoner re-enters the world and a story of loving madness.
Before, there was a mountain of Thorazine fat swaying down the halls in nylon maternity tops and sweatpants. There had been the prettiest girl in Arundale Elementary School, the belle of Landmark Junior High.
I'm Isaiah Sheffer. You're listening to Selected Shorts from PRI. Here are the best actors around performing gripping tales. These are recorded live on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. This edition of Selected Shorts combines two gripping short tales about the power of love, one by a Hungarian political activist and one by Amy Bloom, a favorite American author and essayist who teaches at Wesleyan University. We'll start with the Hungarian Tibor Deri. From his story collection, Love and Other Stories, we'll hear the title story with that single word title. In 1948, Tibor Deri won Hungary's highest artistic honor, the Kossuth Prize. Twice in his life, he was imprisoned, once in 1936 for translating André Gide's diary of his journey to Russia, and again 20 years later for his writing and actions during the Hungarian revolt against Soviet occupation. Deri died in 1977. Reading his story, Love, is a regular Selected Shorts reader, Keir Dulay.
The cell door opened and the guard tossed something in. "Grab it," he said. A sack with a number painted on it fell to the floor in front of the prisoner. B stood up, took a deep breath, and stared at the guard. "Your stuff," said the guard. "Put it on. They're going to shave you." In the sack were the clothes and shoes he had taken off 7 years ago. The clothes were creased and limp, and the shoes moldy. He smoothed out the shirt, which was also moldy, and when he had dressed, the prison barber came in and shaved him. An hour later, they took him to the small office of the prison. Some 8 or 10 prisoners were standing around in the corridor, all wearing their own clothes, but they called him in first, almost as soon as he reached the office door. A sergeant sat at the desk, another stood beside him, and a captain paced slowly up and down the small room. "Come here," said the sergeant at the desk. "Name? Mother's name? Destination?" "I don't know," said B. "What do you mean?" asked the sergeant. "Don't you know your destination?" "No," said B. "I don't know where they'll take me." The sergeant made a wry face. "Ain't taking you nowhere," he said. "You can go home to the old lady for dinner, and tonight you're going to have a piece in bed. You get it?" The prisoner did not answer. "Destination? Number 17 Zsilfa Street. Which district in Budapest?" "Second," said B. "Why are they letting me out?" "Do you understand?" growled the sergeant. "They're letting you out, period. Aren't you glad to get out of this place?" His personal possessions were brought in from the next room. A cheap wristwatch, a fountain pen, and a worn greenish-black wallet that had been his father's. The wallet was empty. "Sign here," said the sergeant. It was a receipt for the wristwatch, the pen, and the wallet. "This one, too." This was another receipt for 146 forints in wages. They counted the money for him at the table. "Put it away," said the sergeant. B took out his wallet and stuffed in the paper money and the change. The musty smell clung to the wallet as well. The last thing he was handed was his letter of discharge. The dotted line marked "reason for arrest" was left blank. He stood around in the corridor for about an hour. Then they escorted him, together with 3 other prisoners, to the main gate. Just before they reached the gate, a sergeant came running out and stopped them. He picked out one of the 4 and marched him back to the prison between 2 guards with Tommy guns. The man's newly shaven face turned a sudden yellow. His eyes became glassy. The 3 went on to the gate. "There's the tram. Get going," said the guard to B when he had searched him and returned his letter of discharge. B stood there, staring at the ground. "What are you waiting for?" asked the guard. B was still standing, surveying the ground at his feet. "Get the hell out," said the guard. "What are you hanging around for?"
"I'm going," said B. "You mean I can go?" The sentry did not answer. B pocketed his letter of discharge and walked through the gate. After a few steps, he wanted to look back, but he checked himself and went on. He listened, but there were no steps behind him. "If I make it to the tram," he thought, "and no one grabs my shoulder or calls out my name from behind, then, presumably, I'm a free man. Or am I?" When he reached the tram stop, he turned suddenly. Nobody was following him. He poked around in his pocket for a handkerchief to wipe the sweat off his forehead, but couldn't find one. He boarded the tram that came screeching along. A prison guard with a pockmarked face was getting off the second car, and, in passing B on the first car, his small piggy eyes looked him up and down. B did not salute. The tram started. At that moment, from that split second onward, when he did not salute the guard and the tram started, just then the world broke into sound. Much as in the cinema when something had gone wrong with the projector and the film had been running silent for a time, and suddenly, right in the middle of a sentence or a word, the sound blasts out of the gaping mouth of the actor. Then the theater, a deaf, mute space, in which the very public seemed deprived of its third dimension, on an instant impulse, is rocked to the rafters with vibrant song, music, and dialogue. All about him, the colors started exploding. The tram, coming from the opposite direction, was yellower than any yellow B had ever seen, and it raced by at such speed past the low, shimmering gray house that B thought it would never get under control again. Across the street, two horses, red as poppies, galloped in front of an empty cart. The enchantment of its rattle made the fairy clouds dance in a mackerel sky. A tiny garden, bottle green, with two sparkling glass globes and an open kitchen window, undulated past. Millions of people milled about the pavements, all in civilian clothes, no two of them alike, and each one lovelier than the other. Many were amazingly small, only knee-high, and some had to be carried. And the women. Since B felt that his eyes were swimming, he went inside the tram. The woman conductor's voice was sonorous and very tender. B bought a ticket and sat down in the first seat at the end of the car. He shut off his senses. If they remained open, he would lose all control. At one moment, he saw out of his window on the pavement opposite the brewery gate a man caressing the cheek of a young woman. He felt again in his trouser pocket for a handkerchief, but there just wasn't one to wipe the fresh beads of sweat from his forehead. A worker sat down on the empty seat across from B with a half dozen bottles of beer in his open briefcase. The conductor laughed. "Won't it be a bit too much?" "I'm a married man, sister," said the worker. "My wife likes to watch her old man have a few." The conductor laughed. "Just watch?" "Sure." "Is it dark beer?" "Right." "But dark beer is nicer." "Yeah, but my wife likes dark to look at." Again, the conductor laughed. "Why don't you leave me a bottle?" "Dark?" "All right, dark." "What for?" "I'll take it home for my husband." "What good is dark to him if he likes some fare?" The conductor laughed. They came to a stop. B got off and hailed a taxi. The taxi driver clanked down the tin flag. "Where to, please?" he said after a while, since his fare said nothing. "To Buda," said B. The taxi driver turned and eyed his passenger. "By which bridge?" B looked straight ahead. "Which bridge, indeed?" "You a stranger here?" asked the taxi driver. "By the Margit Bridge," said B. The cab started. B sat erect, not leaning back. The sunlit street smell of dust and petrol, the clanging bells of the streetcar, rushed through the open cab windows. The sun blazed down freely on both pavements and the shadows of the pedestrians streaking by their feet, seeming to double the volume of traffic. The awnings of a sweet shop had orange stripes that shed russet light on a young woman who sat smoking. Further on at the corner, a small chestnut tree was budding, gathering underneath it a minute patch of lacy, exhilarating shade. "If you could stop for some cigarettes somewhere," said B to the driver. They stopped at the third door. B looked out of the window. They were directly opposite an open door of a small shop with bundles of red radishes, mounds of green lettuce, and red apples in a heap. Beside the shop was the narrow doorway of a tobacconist's. "I'll get him for you," the cab driver said, turning around. "What brand?" B was looking at the radishes. His hands trembled. "Would it be Cathus?" "Yes," said B. "And a box of matches." The taxi driver got out. "Don't bother. We'll put it on the fare. One pack?" "Yes, please," said B. The driver returned. "Would you have one now? My brother-in-law was also in for 2 years. First thing he did was pick up some cigarettes. Smoked 2 cathis, one after the other, before he went home." "Can you tell?" asked B after a while. "Well, maybe a little," said the driver. "My brother-in-law also had such a sick-looking color. Of course, you might come from the hospital, but they don't crease your clothes like that. How long you been in?"
7 years," said B. The driver whistled.
"Political?"
"Yes," said B. "A year and a half in the condemned cell."
"And now they've let you out?"
"Looks like it," said B.
"Does it show a lot?"
The driver shrugged up both shoulders and let them fall again.
7 years," he repeated. "No wonder."
B got out of the taxi at the funicular railway station and walked the rest of the way. He wanted to get used to moving about easily before he met his wife. The taxi driver refused to accept a tip.
"You'll need your money, comrade," he said. "Don't spend it on anything except your health. Get yourself some meat every day and a half bottle of good wine. That'll put you on your feet in no time."
"Goodbye," said B.
Sideways across the street, he saw a narrow mirror in the window of a clothes shop. He stood in front of it for a while and then continued on his way. Since the Passeret Road was full of people, he took a footpath up the hillside, past a tennis court, to Herman Otto Road. But there was too much open space all around him here, with empty lots facing the range of hills opposite. He grew dizzy and sat down on the grass. His wife wasn't expecting him anyway, he thought, so he had time to sit on the grass for half an hour. Facing him was a fence, and behind it stood an apple tree in full bloom. B looked at it for a while and then went over to the fence. The waxy, shining white flowers were so thick on the boughs that looking up from below into the snow-white dome, one could hardly see the stark blue plane of the vibrant sky. Each flower held at its center large round petals, a tinge of pink, a tender touch of color for its bridal splendor. So many bees buzzed in and out of the petals that the trees seemed to have a veil blowing over it in the wind. B stood listening to the tree. He found 2 boughs through which he could look into the sky, while far away a downy cloud looked like yet another apple tree in bloom. He gazed at the 2, through the attainable to the unattainable, till he blacked out. He had forgotten to wind his wristwatch and didn't know how much time had passed since he last left the taxi, so he turned and started for home. After a few steps, he went behind a bush and vomited. He felt relieved. After another half hour's walk through the narrow, sunlit lanes that crisscrossed a hillside of fruit trees in bloom, he arrived at the house. They lived on the first floor. In the garden, to the right and left of the front door, stood 2 white lilac bushes. He went up the front stairs. No one answered the bell. There was no nameplate on the door. He went downstairs to the caretaker's flat and knocked at the door.
Good morning, he said to the woman who opened the door. She, too, looked thinner and had aged.
Are you looking for anyone?
I am B, said B. Is my wife still living here? My God, said the woman. B looked upon the floor. Is my wife still living here? My God, said the woman again. So you've come home? Yes, I'm home, said B. Is my wife still living here? The woman let go of the knob and leaned out against the doorpost. You've come home, she repeated. My God, of course she's living here. And didn't she know that you were coming home either? My God, yes, of course she lives here. My son, too? Asked B. The woman responded. He's fine, she said. He's in fine shape, strong and healthy. Good God. B said nothing. But come right in, said the woman, her voice shaky. Come right in. I knew you were innocent. I knew you'd come home someday. But they didn't open the door, said B. I rang 3 times. Do come in, said the woman again. There's no one home. The other people are also away. B said nothing. He looked upon the floor. Your wife is at work, and Gurika is at school, said the woman. Won't you come in? They'll be home in the afternoon. Are there others in the flat? Asked B. Oh, very decent people, said the woman. Your wife gets along very well with them. Good God, so you did come home. B said nothing. I've got the keys to the flat, said the woman after a while. Perhaps you'd like to go upstairs and rest a little before your wife gets home. On the wall, 2 keys were hanging on a nail. The woman took one and shut the door behind her. Perhaps you'd like to go upstairs and rest, she said. B glanced down at his feet. Are you coming too? He asked. Of course, said the woman. I'll show you which room your wife lives in. In which room does she live? Asked B. Well, you know, the other people are 4 altogether, said the woman. They have 2 rooms. Your wife moved into the maid's room with Gurika, but they share the kitchen and the bathroom. B did not answer. Shall we go on up? Said the woman. Or would you rather wait here with us until they come home? Just come in and stretch out on the sofa till they come home. They share the kitchen and the bathroom? Asked B. Yes, that's right, they share them, said the woman. B raised his head and looked right at the woman. Then, I'm allowed to have a bath? Naturally, said the woman, smiling and putting her hand on B's elbow convincingly. Of course you can have a bath. Why shouldn't you? It's your flat, isn't it? And as I said, the kitchen and the bathroom are shared. I'd be glad to make up a fire for you to warm the water, since we have little of the wood left over from the winter in the cellar. But for all I know, the others keep the bathroom locked in the daytime. B said nothing. He glanced down again. Shall we go upstairs then, or would you rather stop in at our place? Asked the woman. Do come to our place. I'll be in the kitchen and won't disturb you at all. You can lie down on the sofa and maybe even have a nap. Thanks, said B, but I'd rather go upstairs. The maid's room was tiny and faced north, as maid's room usually do. The window looked out on an ornamental tree, and to the left you could see a dark hilltop covered with pines. The foliage in front of the window made the room seem dark green. As soon as he was alone and his breathing had quieted down, he recognized the fragrance of his wife. He sat down near the window and took a deep breath. In the tiny room there were, all told, a worn white cupboard, an iron bedstead, a table, and a chair. To get to the bed, you had to push the chair out of the way. He did not lie down on the bed. He just sat and breathed. The table was piled with many things, books, clothing, toys. There was also a small hand mirror. He looked into it. It showed what the one in the shop window had showed. He put it back on the table, face down. He didn't disturb his wife's things on the table. A child's rubber ball with red dots rested on the ashtray. His wife's fragrance lingered over the table, too. He had hardly sat down when the caretaker's wife came in with a large jug of milky coffee and 2 slices of white bread. He ate it as soon as he was alone. Soon afterward, the ground floor tenant's wife rang the bell. She also brought coffee, bread, and butter, sausage, and a red apple like the ones he had seen in the small shop in the street. She put the tray on the table. His eyes were moist, and she left after a few minutes. When B was alone, he ate it. He still hadn't wound his wristwatch and didn't know how long he'd been sitting near the window. The window looked out on the back garden where there was no one. The tree had leaves with white borders that rustled slightly in the wind, and the afternoon light glowed on the whitewashed walls of the tiny room. When he had breathed in so much of his wife's fragrance that he didn't notice it anymore, he went down into the street near the garden gate. Soon afterward, his wife turned the corner with four or five little boys around her. She came toward the gate, her steps suddenly slackening. She even stopped short for a second and then ran toward him. B also started running without knowing it. As they neared each other, the woman slowed, as if uncertain, but soon ran forward. B recognized the long-sleeved gray woolen pullover she was wearing, which he had bought for her in a shop downtown just before his arrest. His wife was a wonderful blend of air and flesh, unseen and unheard of before, unique. She surpassed everything he had treasured about her for 7 years in prison. When they separated from each other's arms, B leaned against the fence. A few paces behind his wife stood four or five little boys with curious, if somewhat perturbed, faces. They were about 6 or 7 years old. They weren't five, really, only four. Leaning against the fence, B looked at them, one by one. "Which one is mine?" he asked. At this point, she began to cry. "Let's go upstairs," she said, crying. B put his arms around her shoulders. "Don't cry. Let's go upstairs," she said, sobbing openly. "Don't cry," said B. "Which one is mine?" The woman swung open the garden gate and went running between the two lilac bushes to the house. She disappeared in the entrance. She was still as slim as when they had parted, and she ran with the same long, elastic strides as once, when she was a girl, she had run away from a cow with uncontrolled fear in her legs. But when B reached her upstairs in front of the door to the flat, she had calmed down. Only her girlish breasts heaved under her gray sweater. She was no longer crying, but her eyelids were still moist beneath the tears she had wiped away. "My dearest," she whispered, "my dearest." When she whispered, each word could almost be taken in one's mouth as it hung in the air. "Let's go in," said B. "There are other people living in the flat too now." "I know," said B. "Let's go in." "Have you been inside yet?" "I have," said B. "Which is my son?" Once inside, the woman knelt on the floor and put her head in his lap and cried. White threads glistened in her light brown hair with an alien luster. "My darling, I waited for you. My darling." B stroked her head. "Was it hard?" "My darling," whispered the woman. B kept stroking her hair. "Did I grow very old?" The woman clasped his knees and drew him close. "You are the same as when you left for me." "Did I grow very old?" asked B. "I'll love you always as long as I live," whispered the woman. "Do you love me?" asked B. The woman's back trembled. She wept openly. B took his hand from her head. "Can you get used to me?" he asked. "Will you ever get used to me again?" "I have never loved anyone else," she said. "I love you." "Did you wait for me? I was with you every day," said the woman. "There wasn't a day that I didn't think of you. I knew you would come back. But if you didn't, I would have died alone. Your son was you all over again." "Do you love me?" asked B. "I have never loved anyone else," she said. "I'd love you no matter how you've changed." "I have changed," said B. "I've grown old." The woman wept. She pressed B's foot close to her. B stroked her hair again. "Can we still have a child?" she said. "Perhaps," said the man, "if you love me." "Please get up." The woman got up. "Shall I call him?" "Not yet," said B. "Let me stay a while longer with you. He's still a stranger." "Did he stay in the garden?" "I'll go downstairs to him," said the woman. "I'll tell him to wait." When she returned, B was standing at the window with his back to the room. His back was narrow and awry. He did not turn. The woman stood in the doorway for a moment. "I told him to pick some flowers for his father," she said, a little hoarse with emotion. "The lilacs are in bloom all over the next allotment, and he should pick a big bunch for his father." "Do you love me?" asked B. The woman ran up to him, clasped his shoulders, and nestled in close. "My only one," she said. "Can you get used to me?" said B. "I have never loved anyone else," said the woman. "I was with you day and night. Every day I talked to your son about you." B turned around, embraced the woman, and looked closely at her face. In the rays of sunset that fell through the window, he saw with some relief that she, too, had aged, though she was more beautiful than the image he had recalled every day for 7 years. Her eyes were closed, her mouth partly open, and her hot breath touched Bee's cheeks. Thick eyelashes covered the pale skin under her moist eyes. She was meekness itself. Bee kissed her eyes, then tenderly moved her away from himself. "Love our boy, too," she said, with her eyes still closed. "Yes," said Bee. "I'll get to know him and love him. He's your son." "And yours," said Bee. The woman clung to his neck. "I'll wash you," she said. "Good." He stripped. She made the bed, laying her husband's naked body on the sheet. She brought warm water in a tin pan, soap, and two towels. She folded one, dipped it in the water, and put soap on it. She washed the whole body down to his feet. Twice she changed the water. Bee's hand still twitched now and then, but his face was at peace. "Can you get used to me?" he asked. "My darling," said the woman, "will you sleep with me tonight?" "Yes," she said. "Where does the boy sleep?" "I'll make a bed for him on the floor," said the woman. "He sleeps soundly." "Will you stay with me all night?" "Yes," said the woman. "Every night, as long as we live." Thank you.
Pierre Dulay read Tibor Derry's story, Love. After a short pause, we'll hear another emotional powerhouse of a story, this time read by Linda Lavin. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. For more information about the stories you hear or the readers reading them, go to selectedshorts.org or to wnyc.org/shorts. By the way, we'd love to hear your reactions and would be happy to answer any questions you may have. Amy Bloom's Silver Water, our next story, combines hilarity and heartbreaking sorrow in a portrait of a family with a schizophrenic daughter. And Broadway star Linda Lavin's reading at Symphony Space was the occasion of one of the most emotion-filled moments in the history of Selected Shorts. I was standing in my usual place in the wings as her terrific reading brought the audience in the theater, and me too, to peals of deep laughter and pangs of deep sadness, all at the same time. When it was over, the audience, stirred and delighted and grief-stricken, paused and then gave Linda a tumultuous ovation. I'll never forget her coming off stage and falling into my arms, giving way to all the feelings herself, and as her tears streamed down my face and neck, I heard her murmur, "I think we got a winner here, Isaiah." And I think you'll think so, too. Linda Lavin reads Amy Bloom's Silver Water.
My sister's voice was like mountain water in a silver pitcher. The clear blue beauty of it cools you, lifts you up beyond your heat, beyond your body. After we went to see La Traviata when she was 14 and I was 12, she elbowed me in the parking lot and said, "Check this out." And she opened her mouth unnaturally wide, and her voice came out so crystalline and bright that all the departing opera-goers stood frozen by their cars, unable to take out their keys or open their doors until she had finished, and then they cheered like hell. That's what I like to remember, and that's the story I told to all of her therapists. I wanted them to know her, to know that who they saw was not all there was to see. That before the constant tinkling of commercials and fast food jingles, there had been Puccini and Mozart and hymns so sweet and mighty you expected Jesus to come down off his cross and clap. That before there was a mountain of Thorazine fat swaying down the halls in nylon maternity tops and sweatpants, there had been the prettiest girl in Arundale Elementary School, the belle of Landmark Junior High. Maybe there were other pretty girls, but I didn't see them. To me, Rose, my beautiful blonde defender, my guide to Tampax and my mother's moods was perfect. She had her first psychotic break when she was 15. She had been coming home moody and tearful, then quietly beaming. Then she stopped coming home. She would go out into the woods behind our house and not come in until my mother would go out at dusk and gently step into the briars and saplings and pull her out, blank-faced, her pale blue pullover covered with crumbly leaves, her white jeans smeared with dirt. After 3 weeks of this, my mother, who is a musician and widely regarded as eccentric, said to my father, who is a psychiatrist and a kind, sad man, "She's going off." "What is that, your professional opinion?" He picked up the newspaper and put it down again, sighing. "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to snap at you. I know something's bothering her. Have you talked to her?" "What's there to say? David, she's going crazy. She doesn't need a heart-to-heart talk with Mom. She needs a hospital." They went back and forth, and my father sat down with Rose for a few hours and sat there licking the hairs on her forearm, first one way, then the other. My mother stood in the hallway, dry-eyed and pale, watching the two of them. She had already packed Rose's bag, and when three of my father's friends dropped by to offer free consultations and recommendations, my mother and Rose's suitcase were already in the car. My mother hugged me and told me that they would be back that night, but not with Rose. She also said, divining my worst fear, "It won't happen to you, honey. Some people go crazy, and some people never do. You never will." She smiled and stroked my hair. "Not even when you want to." Rose was in hospitals, great and small, for the next 10 years. She had lots of terrible therapists and a few good ones. One place had no pictures on the walls, no windows, and the patients all wore slippers with the hospital crest on them. My mother didn't even bother to go to admissions. She turned Rose around and two of them marched out, my father trailing behind them, apologizing to his colleagues. My mother ignored the psychiatrists, the social workers, and the nurses, and she played Handel and Bessie Smith for the patients on whatever piano was available. At some places, she had a Steinway donated by a grateful or optimistic family. At others, she banged out "Gimme a Pig Foot" on an old scarred box that hadn't been tuned since there'd been English-speaking physicians on the grounds. My father talked in serious, appreciative voices to the administrators and unit chiefs and tried to be friendly with whoever was managing Rose's case. We all hated family therapists. The worst family therapist we ever had sat in a pale green room with us, visibly taking stock of my mother's ethereal beauty and her faded blue t-shirt and girl-sized jeans, my father's rumpled suit and stained tie, and my own unreadable 16-year-old fashion statement. Rose was beyond fashion that year in one of her dancing teddy bear smocks and extra-large Celtic sweatpants. Mr. Walker read Rose's file in front of us and then watched in alarm as Rose began crooning beautifully and slowly massaging her breasts. My mother and I started to laugh, and even my father started to smile. This was Rose's usual opening salvo for new therapists. Mr. Walker said, "I wonder why it is that everyone is so entertained by Rose behaving inappropriately." Rose burped, and then we all really laughed. This was the seventh family therapist we had seen, and none of them had lasted very long. Mr. Walker, unfortunately, was determined to do right by us. "What do you think of Rose's behavior, Violet?" They did this sometimes. In their manual, it must say, "If you think the parents are too weird, try talking to the sister." "I don't know. Maybe she's trying to get you to stop talking about her in the third person." "Nicely put," my father said. "Indeed," my mother said. "F***ing A," Rose said. "Well, this is something that the whole family agrees upon," Mr. Walker said, trying to act as if he understood or even liked us. "That was not a successful intervention, ferret face." Rose tended to function better when she was angry. He did look like a blonde ferret, and we all laughed again. Even my father, who tried to give these people a chance out of some sense of collegiality, had given it up. Mr. Walker decided after 14 minutes that our time was up and walked out, leaving us grinning at each other. Rose was still nuts, but at least we'd all had a little fun. Our best family therapist started out almost as badly. We scared off a resident and then scared off her supervisor, who sent us Dr. Thorne. 300 pounds of Texas chili, cornbread, and Lone Star beer, finished off with big black cowboy boots and a little string tie around the area of his neck. "Oh, frabjous day, it's Big Nut." Rose was in heaven and stopped massaging her breasts immediately. "Hey, little nut. You have to understand how big a man would have to be to call my sister Little Nut." He christened us all right away. And it's the good Dr. Nut and Madam Hickory Nut, because they are all the hardest damn nuts to crack. And over here in the overalls and not much else is no one's nut. A name which summed up both my sanity and my loneliness. We all relaxed. Dr. Thorne was good for us. Rose moved into a halfway house whose director loved Big Nut so much she kept Rose even when Rose went through a period of having sex with everyone who passed her door. She was in a fever for a while, trying to still the voices by f***ing her brains out. Big Nut said, "Darling, I can't. I cannot make love to every beautiful woman I meet. And furthermore, I can't do that and be your therapist, too. It's a great shame, but I think you might be able to find a really nice guy, someone who treats you just as sweet and kind as I would if I were lucky enough to be your beau. I don't want you to settle for less." And she stopped propositioning the crack addicts and the alcoholics and the guys at the shelter. We love Dr. Thorne. My father cut back on seeing rich neurotics and helped out one day a week at Dr. Thorne's walk-in clinic. My mother finished a record of Mozart concerti and played at fundraisers for Rose's halfway house. I went back to college and found a wonderful linebacker from Texas to sleep with. In the dark, I would make him call me darling. Rose took her meds, lost about 50 pounds, and began singing at the AME Zion Church down the street from the halfway house. At first, they didn't know what to do with this big blonde lady dressed funny and hovering wistfully in the doorway during their rehearsals. But she gave them a few bars of Precious Lord, and the choir director felt God's hand and saw that with the help of his sweet child Rose, the Prospect Street Choir was going all the way to the Gospel Olympics. Amidst a sea of beige, umber, cinnamon, and espresso faces, there was Rose, bigger and blonder and pinker than any two white women could be. and Rose and the choir's contralto, Addie Robichaud, laid out their gold and silver voices and wove them together in strands as fine as silk, as strong as steel. And we wept as Rose and Addie in their billowing garnet robes swayed together, clasping hands until the last perfect note floated up to God, and then they smiled down on us. Rose would still go off from time to time, and the voices would tell her to do bad things, but Dr. Thorne or Addie or my mother could usually bring her back after 5 good years. Dr. Thorne, Big Nut, died, stuffing his face with a chili dog sitting in his unair-conditioned office in the middle of July. He had one big Texas-sized aneurysm and died. Rose held on tight for several days. She took her meds, went to cry practice, and rearranged her room about 100 times. His funeral was a Lourdes for the mentally ill. If you were psychotic, borderline, bad off neurotic, or just very hard to get along with, you were there. People shaking so bad from years of heavy meds that they fell out of their pews. People holding hands, crying, moaning, talking to themselves. The crazy and the not so crazy were all huddled together like puppies at the pound. Rose stopped taking her meds, and the halfway house wouldn't keep her after she pitched another patient down the stairs. My father called the insurance company and found out that Rose's new improved psychiatric coverage wouldn't begin for 45 days. I put all of her stuff in a garbage bag, and we walked out of the halfway house, Rose winking at the poor drooling boy on the couch. This is going to be difficult. Not all bad, but difficult for the whole family, and I thought we should discuss everybody's expectations. I know I have some concerns. My father had convened a family meeting as soon as Rose had finished putting each one of her 30 stuffed bears in its own special place. No meds, Rose said. Her eyes lowered, her stubby fingers, those fingers that had braided my hair and painted tulips on my cheeks, pulling hard on the hem of her dirty smock. My father looked in despair at my mother. Rosie, do you want to drive the car? My mother said. Rosie's face lit up. I'd love to drive that car. I'll drive to California. I'd go see the bears at the San Diego Zoo. I would take you, Violet, but you always hated the zoo. Remember how you cried at the Bronx Zoo when she found out that the animals didn't get to go home at closing? Rose put her damp hand on mine and squeezed it sympathetically. Poor Vi. If you take your medication, after a while you'll be able to drive the car. That's the deal. Meds, car. My mother sounded accommodating but unenthusiastic, careful not to heat up Rose's paranoia. You got yourself a deal, darling. I was living about an hour away then, teaching English during the day, writing poetry at night, and I went home every few days for dinner. I called every night. My father said quietly, "It's very hard. We're doing all right, I think. Rose has been walking in the mornings with your mother, and she watches a lot of TV. She won't go to the day hospital, and she won't go back to the choir. Her friend, Mrs. Robichaud, came by a couple of times. What a sweet woman." Rose wouldn't even talk to her. She just sat there staring at the wall and humming. "We're not doing all that well, actually, but I guess we're getting by. I'm sorry, sweetheart. I don't mean to depress you." My mother said emphatically, "We're doing fine. We've got our routine and we stick to it and we're fine. You don't need to come home so often, you know. Wait till Sunday. Just come for the day. Lead your life, Vi. She's leading hers." I stayed away till Sunday, afraid to pick up my phone, grateful to my mother for the harsh calm and her reticence, the qualities that had enraged me throughout my childhood. I came on a Sunday in the early afternoon to help my father garden, something we'd always enjoyed together. We weeded and staked tomatoes and killed aphids while my mother and Rose went down to the lake. I didn't even get into the house until 4 when I needed a glass of water. Someone had broken the piano bench into 5 neatly stacked pieces and placed them where the piano bench usually was. "We were having such a nice time, I couldn't bear to bring it up," my father said, standing in the doorway, carefully keeping his gardening boots out of the kitchen. "What did Mommy say?" She said, better the bench than the piano. And your sister lay down on the floor and just wept. Then your mother took her down to the lake. This can't go on, Vi. We have 27 days left. Your mother gets no sleep because Rose doesn't sleep. And if I could just pay $27,000 to keep her in the hospital until the insurance takes over, I'd do it. All right, do it. Pay the money and take her back to Hartley Reese. It was the prettiest place, and she liked the art therapy there. I would if I could. The policy states that she must be symptom-free for at least 45 days before her coverage begins. Symptom-free means no hospitalization. Jesus, Daddy, how could you get that kind of policy? She hasn't been symptom-free for 45 minutes. It's the only one I could get for long-term psychiatric. He put his hand over his mouth to block whatever he was about to say and went back out to the garden. I couldn't see if he was crying. He stayed outside and I stayed inside until Rose and my mother came home from the lake. Rose's soggy sweatpants were rolled up to her knees and she had a bucket full of shells and gray stones, which my mother persuaded her to leave on the back porch. My mother kissed me lightly and told Rose to go up to her room and change out of her wet pants. Rose's eyes grew very wide. Never. I will never. She began banging her head with rhythmic intensity against the kitchen floor, throwing all of her weight behind each attack. My mother put her arms around Rose's waist and tried to hold her back. Rose shook her off, not even looking around to see what was slowing her down. My mother crumpled next to the refrigerator. Violet, please. I threw myself onto the kitchen floor, becoming the spot that Rose was smacking her head against. She stopped a fraction of an inch short of my stomach. Oh, Vi, Mummy, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Don't hate me. She staggered to her feet and ran wailing to her room. My mother got up and washed her face brusquely, rubbing it dry with a dishcloth. My father heard the wailing and came running in, slipping his long bare feet out of his rubber boots. Galen, let me see. He held her head and looked closely for bruises on her pale, small face. What happened? My mother looked at me. Violet, what happened? Where's Rose? Rose got upset, and when she went running upstairs, she pushed Mommy out of the way. I've only told 3 lies in my life, and that was my second. She must feel terrible pushing you of all people. It would have to be you, but I know she didn't want it to be. He made my mother a cup of tea and all the love he had for her, despite her silent rages and her vague stares, came pouring through the teapot, warming her cup, filling her small, long-fingered hands. He stood by her, and she rested her head against his hip. I looked away. Let's make dinner, then I'll call her. Or you call her, David. Maybe she'd rather see your face first. Dinner was filled with all of our starts and stops and Rose's desperate efforts to control herself. She could barely eat and hummed the McDonald's theme song over and over again, pausing only to spill her juice down the front of her smock and begin weeping. My father looked at my mother and handed Rose his napkin. She dabbed at herself listlessly, but the tears stopped. I want to go to bed. I want to go to bed and be in my head. I want to go to bed and be in my head and just wear red. For red is the color that my baby wore, and once more it's true. Yes, it is. It's true. Please don't wear red tonight. Oh, please don't wear red tonight, for red is the color. Okay, Rose, it's okay. I'll go upstairs with you, and you can get ready for bed. Then Mommy will come up and say goodnight, too. It's okay, Rose. My father reached out his hand, and Rose grasped it, and they walked out of the dining room together, and his long arm was around her middle. My mother sat at the table for a moment, her face in her hands, and then she began clearing the table. We cleared without talking, my mother humming Schubert's Schlummerlied, a lullaby about the woods and the river calling to the child to go to sleep. She sang it to us every night when we were small. My father came back into the kitchen and signaled to my mother. She went upstairs and they came back down together a few minutes later. She's asleep, they said, and we went to sit on the porch and listen to the crickets. I don't remember the rest of the evening, but I remember it as quietly sad, and I remember the rare sight of my parents holding hands. Sitting on the picnic table. Watching the sunset. I woke up at 3 a.m. Feeling the cool night air through my sheet. I went down the hall for another blanket and looked into Rose's room for no reason. She wasn't there. I put on my jeans and a sweater and went downstairs. I could feel her absence. I went outside and saw her wide, draggy footprints darkening the wet grass. Into the woods. Rosie? I called, too softly, not wanting to wake my parents, not wanting to startle Rose. Rosie? It's me. Are you there? Are you all right? I almost fell over her. Huge and white in the moonlight. Her flowered smock bleached in the light and shadow, her sweatpants now completely wet. Her head was flung back, her white, white neck exposed like a lost Greek column. Rosie, Rosie. Her breathing was very slow, and her lips were not as pink as they usually were. Her eyelids fluttered. Closing time, she whispered. I believe that's what she said. I sat with her, uncovering the bottle of white pills by her hand, and watched the stars fade. When the stars were invisible and the sun was warming the air, I went back to the house. My mother was standing on the porch, wrapped in a blanket, watching me. Every step I took overwhelmed me. I could picture my mother slapping me, shooting me for letting her favorite die. Warrior queens, she said, wrapping her thin, strong arms around me. I raised warrior queens. She kissed me fiercely and went into the woods by herself. A little later, she woke my father, who could not go into the woods, and still later, she called the police and the funeral parlor. She hung up the phone, lay down, and didn't get back out of bed until the day of the funeral. My father fed us both and called the people who needed to be called and picked out Rose's coffin by himself. My mother played the piano and Addie sang her pure gold notes, and I closed my eyes and saw my sister, 14 years old, lion's mane thrown back and her eyes tightly closed against the glare of the parking lot lights. That sweet sound held us tight, flowing around us. Eddying through our hearts, rising, still rising.
Wow. The reader was Linda Lavin, and the story was Silver Water by Amy Bloom, whose newest book is called Where the God of Love Hangs Out.
In spring, legt sich hin, lässt über sich die Wolken ziehen.
Amy Bloom joined me from her home to talk about this great story. So, Amy, Silver Water, what inspired the story? It's one of the most remarkable stories we've ever had at Selected Shorts. And was it based in part on someone you encountered in your own practice as a caregiver?
I wouldn't say so. I mean, I actually didn't know anybody like that family. But I had done work when I was a graduate student at Yale Psychiatric Hospital, and I worked with a lot of very old school psychiatrists who believed that some people could be helped. And made a real effort, and I also got to see a lot of people who, in fact, were not going to be able to be helped. But the only character, I think, in that entire story that was based on somebody that I knew was the psychiatrist that helped the family, Big Nut. I had, as a college student, a very warm, southern-accented, boundary-violating psychotherapist myself, and this was, I think, sort of my tribute to him.
Now, one of the amazing things that makes this a distinguished story is the way in which you somehow have contrived to combine really intense hilarity. The story is very funny, with the deepest of sorrow and heartbreak. Did you know that this was your goal in setting out to write the story, that it would be both funny and deeply poignant?
I don't think I knew that. I mean, I think to some extent, as a writer, you write as you are. I think for me, those things tend to come woven together.
Now, did you hear Linda Lavin's reading?
I did. That was wonderful.
Have you ever read the story in public aloud?
I have. It's hard work. That story, and there's a story in this new collection called Compassion and Mercy. And I have the same trouble with both stories, which is that there are a lot of funny things in it, and there's a lot of very painful stuff in it. And I find that as I'm reading, I have to not be overcome by feeling myself, which is a funny thing, having written the story.
Well, as the listener can hear, Linda Lavin was fairly overcome with feeling, and that lent a lot of effect to the way in which it reached an audience. I was weeping in the wings.
Oh, I'm glad. I suppose part of it is that I think you should write about things that matter to you.
Tell us about, you mentioned your new collection of short stories entitled Where the God of Love Hangs Out. What sort of directions are you taking in that volume?
Well, I think as one of my daughters said to me, oh, Mommy, it's the same old thing, love, death, sex, and family. And I think she's pretty much right. I think those are the things that I write about, and those are the things that are interesting to me.
Well, thanks, Amy, and I hope we'll see you around Symphony Space one of these days.
Of course.
That was the author, Amy Bloom. We heard her story, Silver Water, read by Linda Lavin. Did you enjoy that great story? Have you thought about writing one of your own? Well, here's your chance. The 2011 Stella Kupferberg Memorial Short Story Contest. This year's theme is stories set in restaurants and bars. The judge is the author Jennifer Egan, and the deadline is March 1st, 2011. All the details can be found at selectedshorts.org. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The president of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott, and the artistic director of Symphony Space is Laura Kaminsky. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts has been provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of The Best American Short Stories, edited in 2010 by Richard Russo. Additional support has been provided by Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, Seedlings Foundation, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts is also supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.